very grateful to be here today and very grateful to be clean. First thing I'd like to say is I'd like to thank this committee for giving me the privilege to come up here and share some of the experience I have learned here in Narcotics Anonymous. I'm not going to sit here and tell you a bunch of war stories or anything like that. I want to talk about how I feel. When he first gave me this topic, I had to think about it, and I think what it meant to me, how it worked in my life, and how I felt about it. And I was riding up here with a couple of guys who have been friends of mine for many, many years in Narcotics Anonymous. And they reminded me of all the secrets that I had. They told me if I ran out of things to say, they would remind me. And that's what this fellowship's about. It's about people knowing each other. It's about trusting in others. I came into this fellowship a few years ago. The only thing I can remember when I walked in the doors of my first meeting was that I was scared. Didn't know what I was afraid of, but I knew I was scared. A lot of things I'm going to talk about here tonight are things I've learned since I've been in Narcotics Anonymous. By working the 12 steps and by going to meetings and sharing how I feel. About trusting in the process that happens here. The things that happened here in Narcotics Anonymous to me I've never seen happen anywhere else. The feelings I have today I never had before in my life. Today, fear no longer rules my life. I come here because I want to. I come here because I need to. And that's why I show up. I'll give you a little background about where I come from and how I wound up here in Narcotics Anonymous. And about the topic that I was chosen to speak on tonight, about sick as my secrets. I don't know if it's so much about having secrets and the things that I had done in my life. I think the thing that was secret to me is how I felt about the things that I did. How it made me feel on the inside, most of all, what other people thought about what I did. I come from a neighborhood down New Jersey or outside New York City. And I was nothing but a street corner addict. You know, nickel and dime hustler is what I did most of my life. I come from a family where alcoholism and drug addiction was a way of life. They either got drunk, shot dope, went to prison. These were the people that I knew growing up. Obviously, I didn't talk much about how they felt. Everybody kept to themselves. I mean, I come from a family where the people I knew growing up that were related to me were very unemotional, available people. The only two things that were shown in my house, feelings or anything else, was anger and depression. You know, either you were really angry about something or you felt sorry for yourself, basically. And the only time I see anybody smile is when they're under the influence of drugs or alcohol. So I thought this was the normal thing to do, you know. The feelings I had as a young boy that were inside my gut, inside my belly, I thought there was something wrong with me because I didn't hear anybody else talking about how I felt. I never talked to anybody in my family talked about love and caring and being there for one another. Certainly the guys in the corner I hung out with didn't talk about that. I didn't walk on the corner looking to come, somebody gave me a hug and asked me how my day was. That's not what my life was about before I came here. A lot of things I did in my addiction before I showed up in Narcotics Anonymous I wasn't proud of. And I did things I never thought I'd do under the influence of drugs and alcohol. There's a lot of things that I did on the street that a lot of addicts did. I never thought anybody felt the way I felt. I guess my biggest secret was that I thought I was different than you. That if you knew who I was, you would not like me. That you would not accept me. And that I'd be an outcast from the people I hung around with. I guess my biggest secret, like I said before, was fear. Everything I did in active addiction was out of fear. It was out of fear of being found out about who I was, about what I felt like, what I thought of myself, and what you thought of me. And, you know, I had this image I had on the street that I had to live up to. You know, I thought I was this big, tough guy, you know, that I wasn't afraid of nothing or nobody. And I was afraid of everything. It was all about that wall that I had put up not to let you know who I was. Now, not letting you get close enough, because if you got close enough to me, you would hurt me. And I was afraid of people hurting me. I was afraid of being alone. I was afraid of being abandoned. I was afraid of not being loved. Those are things.
And the first time, the second time, the time after that, when I picked up that first drug, I saw it inside my belly. All of everything that I felt inside that seemed mad to me at that particular point, I didn't care about anymore. Also, it didn't matter if I felt loved or if you accepted me or I was abandoned. I felt warm on the inside and I felt okay with Eddie. That was the thing I was looking for the first 13 years of my life as a young boy, to feel okay in my own skin. And when I got high, I felt that way.
When I got high, I felt there was nothing I couldn't do or nothing I couldn't be. And it just didn't matter what you thought or anybody else thought. You know, it was a lot easier to hang out in the corner or playing ball and putting a lot of effort into it or being good at school. All I had to do was open a can of beer, roll a joint, take whatever the drug choice was at that time. All the problems were, the fear was gone.
I went on like for many years. And there was a lot of things doing that nobody knew what I was doing. You know, I was a very killer. I don't say I had low self-esteem. I had low self-esteem after 3 years in this program. I came in here. The things I done to myself and the positions I put myself in, if I had any self-esteem whatsoever, I would have known. The first detail. General Hibberts. Was there clearly here and there was only a handful of me going up? The Hunter Detailers. I was introduced to a fellowship and asked the first message I heard. I walked the detox and he had this big guy I was. You know, I was close to 300 pounds, I had hair break down my back, hadn't slept in God knows how long. But I was cool. You know, I was cool. And I walked in there and that fear was back. See, somewhere along the line of my addiction, what drugs and alcohol had done for me were no longer working. They weren't taking away the fear anymore. They weren't taking away the pain. All they did was enhance and create the problems that I had. I got caught up in that vicious cycle that the literature talks about. Or I couldn't get off that merry-go-round. You see, the more I did, the worse I felt, and the worse I felt, the more I did, and I didn't know how to stop. I didn't know I had to stop. I didn't even know if I wanted to stop. Because I was holding on to something that worked at one time. At one time in my life, this had worked for me. And I tried desperately for many years to get back that feeling that first time I picked up. I spent 13 years of active addiction trying to get back that feeling I had the first time I got high. And no matter where I went or what I did, I could never recapture that feeling. Religion talks about that comfort and ease that we once knew. There was no more comfort and ease in my life. Didn't matter how much drugs I did, the pain wouldn't go away. I was left with an alternative. What do I do? I thought about killing myself. I thought having somebody else take me out. Because the things I was doing, one way or the other, either I was going to kill myself or somebody was. And at that particular point in my life, that was okay with me. See, I didn't like what I was doing. I didn't like who I was. My self-esteem told me I was a piece of shit. But I couldn't go to anybody and tell them I'm scared. It was another thing that I grew up with in my family. Because I knew my family were hard drinkers, they were drug addicts, they were in and out of jail. You know, they weren't afraid of nobody. And that was not me. As hard as I tried for that to be me, it just wasn't. I had found out when I came here in Narcotics Anonymous that I was a soft, loving, caring man. And I couldn't say that when I walked in here. Because I didn't know what I was feeling, what those feelings were about. Everything was masked with fear. What happened to me and how I wound up here was not of my own doing. I didn't wake up one day and say, listen, man, I'm going to an NA meeting because I got to stop using. I definitely believe what happened to me was divine intervention. That a God of my understanding saw fit to choose me out of whoever was there on that corner and save me. To this day, I still don't know, and it doesn't matter to me anymore. All I know is I'm here, I have the opportunity to grow and to recover and to become a more healthy, more loving, more caring individual. And that happens here for me in Narcotics Anonymous. I was sitting in a place I've been sitting for many years and feeling the way I've been feeling for a long, long time. And I remember going to my little brother and telling him I couldn't live the way I was living anymore. I just didn't know what to do. There was this big, tough guy hanging out in the corner, sitting in a room crying his eyes out, couldn't deal with life anymore. I didn't have the ability to deal with life on life's terms. I was never taught how to deal with life. I guess I never wanted to know. One thing that I had inside of me that I would never tell anybody was that I wanted all my life for somebody to talk to. For somebody to walk up to and tell them how I felt and not laugh at how I felt. Or not tell me that I was wrong for what I was feeling. Or to walk up to that stupid man, why do you feel like that? You should feel this way. And early in my life as a young man, as a teenager, when I tried to express those feelings to my family and people that I knew on the street,
those are the words that I got. Those are the responses that I got. So somewhere along the line, I had closed down emotionally because I didn't want that coming back. Because somewhere inside of me, I didn't feel right. Something told me that's not the way it should be. And I had walked into this detox, and I had been there about 7 or 8 days. And there was this guy who came in. His name was John D. He was an old dope fiend from East New York. He came in and he told his story. I don't know, maybe the fog had lifted, or maybe this is what my higher power put in my life, to turn the lights on and get the bells ringing. And he had told his story. And he wasn't a real dramatic speaker, you know, he was just an average guy. He was sitting there with a sport jacket on, you know. He looked good. He didn't have that look of death in his eyes. I looked in the man's eyes, there was something there, you know, besides two black holes. And he sat there and he started talking about how he felt. See, before that, I had people coming in from other fellowships, and they told a lot of war stories, you know, about how much they did and where they did it, and did this big routine, and I don't know, I didn't get nothing out of it. And John just sat down and gave us a real simple message. He told 32 people in his rehab how he felt. And I'm sitting there, I'm saying to myself, I said, what is this guy doing? Why is he telling everybody in this room how he feels? He's not supposed to do that. He's not supposed to tell people these things. As the time went on, as he got halfway through his story, my thought had changed. And the thought that changed said, that guy feels just like me, man. He's been to the places I've been. He's done a lot of things I have done. But most of all, he felt like I did after doing the things that he did. And that totally amazed me, man. Because I've never sat down and heard anybody talk about how they felt. And look me in the eye and be honest. And something inside me said, I want what that guy has. For the first time in my life, I felt like I was in a place that just maybe there'd be somebody there who'd listen how I feel. That just maybe I could tell somebody the shit that's inside of me that's making me nuts. And as I started sharing with him, as he started sharing with me, I felt like I wasn't so different anymore. And I had this big thing about being unique, you know, that I couldn't go on the call and tell everybody, well, man, I'm different than you. I feel different. See, I got a sense of something. You know, and when nobody around, I cry. The neighborhood I come from, you couldn't go on the corner and cry. It just wasn't a thing to do. You wouldn't last too long. And he told me about this fellowship called Narcotics Anonymous. And I said, if Narcotics Anonymous is a bunch of drug addicts that sit around drinking coffee, smoking cigarettes, and talking. Why I trust this old dope fiend, I don't know. But he took me to my first meeting on a Friday night in the area that I belonged to. And I walked up the stairs. There's one guy who was there at the top of the stairs, and his name was Ed, too, and he gave me a hug. My first reaction was, whoa. The second reaction was, that felt good. And he knew it was my first meeting. And the area I come from, the fellowship was so small, everybody knew everybody. You know, when you sneeze, somebody knew it. And he always knew. And he told me to come down and sit down and relax and listen. That I was welcome here at Narcotics Anonymous. And they didn't want anything from me. They just wanted me to show up. I heard these in this room talking about fearless. And it was just like I was. The only difference between them is they weren't used anymore. And I sat there and I listened. And again, I wanted what they had to offer. I went to another meeting and another meeting, and they started talking steps, those things that were secrets of mine that I had that I wasn't able to live life with, that held me back from things that I always wanted to do. So I grew up, and I had this dream about growing up and being married and having kids and living in this big, nice house, you know, with the dog and the car. I had that growing up as a kid. You know, I seen it on TV, and I wanted those things. And these people at that meeting were talking about those things that I wanted. And they told me, if I wanted what they had, I had to come and get it. At that particular point in my life, I was so motivated by pain that I would do just about anything anybody ever told me to do. I was that scared. And when I stuck up my hand and told people I was scared, nobody ran away. Nobody came up and tried to take me off. Nobody tried to take advantage of me. They came up, they gave me a hug, they told me, I know how you feel, Ed. We feel the same way. We felt just like that. And this is what we did, not to feel like that anymore. And I came to believe, you know, I took the first step. I knew if I didn't use, And what these people told me, that my life would get better, or I would get better. And the first year or so of my recovery, I was showing up to meetings and I wasn't talking very much. I wasn't telling people too much on how I felt. See, I could talk on a topic real easy and talk about what was in the text. That was the easy thing to do. But for me, when I first came to NA, we used to have, they were just plain discussion meetings. There were no qualifications. They would open up the meeting and they would say, does anybody have anything to share? You'd stick up your hand and you had to talk about how you felt. And I didn't have the skills to do that. But there was something inside of me that was about to explode if I didn't take that risk. I think this topic has a lot to do with taking that risk, about having faith in the process that happens here, about trusting another human being and a God of my understanding. The second step told me to come to believe in a power greater than me. And that was Narcotics Anonymous. So I didn't want to have anything to do with God yet because I felt I still got dealt a bad hand. And that told me if I showed up here and did what you told me to do, that I would get better. And I seen people in the meeting that looked like they were enjoying life. I was walking around tensed up, angry most of the time, and I could not take it no more. There were certain things I was still doing in recovery that I had done in active addiction. And a real turning point for me in my recovery that opened up, so to speak, the floodgates to allow me to feel and tell people exactly how I felt and some of the things I had done. And it took me a couple of years to do my first fourth step. I guess I was clean about a year and a half. And part of my active addiction was a sexual addiction. And having a low self-esteem that I had, and the low self-worth that I had, I didn't think anyone wanted to have anything to do with me. So needless to say, I went to New York City and I paid for what I wanted. The last 4 years of my addiction was no money to do anything. I was stealing just to get high. And I wasn't out of rehab one day when they broke that gate and I was over in New York doing what I was doing. And every time I had done something like that, the shame that I had felt about the act that I had just committed was killing me. It triggered the shame and the fear that I had growing up as a boy and of the things that I had done in my act of addiction. And I was talking to these two friends of mine yesterday about this. I had walked into a meeting on a Sunday night, and I thought nobody in Narcotics Anonymous did what I did. That I was, again, unique in what I felt. I walked up to this guy, his name was Mitch. He was a big biker guy. He was about 350 pounds, the size of a house. And you wouldn't think he would be the big, sensitive guy that he was. And I had known him since I got clean. We got clean together. And he took one look at me. He goes, what's wrong? And the only thing that would come out of my mouth is, I want to get high so bad I can taste it. And he pulled me outside the meet and I started to cry. He goes, what's wrong, Eddie? And for the first time in all the years that I had been clean and been in active addiction, see, nobody knew what I did, even when I was active. This was the one thing I would never tell anybody. You know, how could you do something like that? You know? And I looked him in the eye and I told him what I was doing, and Mitch turned around and he laughed at me. I said, what the hell are you laughing about? He goes, I did the same thing. And he goes, you know what? He goes, probably 80% of the guys in Narcotics Anonymous, maybe more, if they got honest, did the same thing. The sense of relief that I had felt about letting this thing out that I've been carrying around for many, many years was like the weight of the world was taken off my shoulders. And I was able to loosen up a little bit more and talk a little bit more freely about what was going on inside of me. And this guy, John D, I had spoken about earlier, had become my sponsor. And I had developed a trust in this man. Because I was telling him things and he wasn't telling anybody else. And he never judged me once for the way I felt or for the things I had done. He sat there, he listened. He gave me some suggestions. He told me some of the things that he'd done which made me feel not so unique. And I had come to a point where I had to do a fourth step in my life. I had to get out everything that was inside me once and for all and become as honest as I could be. They talked about a fearless moral inventory. Most of my secrets I thought was a moral deficiency that I had. I had the disease of addiction. And under the influence of chemicals, I did things I wouldn't do if I wasn't under the influence. That I had served a lower power for many years. And this is why I did the things that I did. And there was a lot of fear going to that word fearless, you know. It really was a sticking point for me. And I was as honest as I could be. And to sit down with another human being and look him in the eye in the presence of the God of my understanding and tell him about me, about how I felt, about the things I had done, was a freeing experience for me. It was the groundwork that I needed to lay for the recovery that I have today. And I'm not perfect, and I still do things that are not conducive to my recovery. I'm a human being. I do the best I can on a daily basis. And I have friends in my life who let me know when I'm not doing the right thing. Because they know about me. They know what makes me do the things that I do. They know how I feel when I do certain things. And sometimes I'm so blinded by my anger or about the feelings that I have that I don't care about the consequences. So I know when I do things today, the insanity for me is not repeating the same mistake and expecting a different result. It's doing the same thing and knowing what I'm going to get. And each time I do that, I say to myself, I can handle it. I know what the price tag is. And every time I do it, I can't handle it. And the price tag is bigger than I thought it was. That's why I need to come here as much as I do and do the things I do here in Narcotics Anonymous. So I don't become as sick as I once was. Today I'm a recovering addict. And I say it every time I introduce myself. Because every day I wake up, I take another step forward. I am no longer that sleazeball that I thought I once was. I'm no longer that piece of shit I thought that walked the streets. Today I have self-esteem. Some days it's better than others. But Narcotics Anonymous and the people in there have taught me how to deal with those days that are not so good. And tell me that I don't have to be ashamed of how I feel. That I don't have to be ashamed that I'm an addict. And I don't have to be ashamed that I feel like using sometimes. And I don't have to be ashamed that my ego is so big that I can't tell somebody that. I don't have to feel ashamed to ask somebody that I need a hug. And that I feel lonely and I feel unloved and please somebody hold me. And I got that here in Narcotics Anonymous. Never got that at home, never got that on a street corner, never got it nowhere I've ever been, but I got it here. And that's the love I have for Narcotics Anonymous. It has given me those things. It has taught me that I don't have to get to that point anymore before I can stop and say, listen, man, this is what I'm thinking. This is what I want to do. I really don't want to do it, but if I don't talk about it, I will. That's the gift I've been given here. That's the gift of recovery. And I wouldn't have that if I didn't show up on a regular basis. I attend meetings regularly. The literature says that those who come to meetings regularly stay clean. And to me, that doesn't mean once a month or once every 2 months, or to come to pick up a coin or a key tag on a celebration. That means showing up here. That means sticking my hand out to the newcomer, because somebody had stuck their hand out to me. That means getting up and going into a detox and carrying a message with H&I. That means when one of the guys that I sponsor calls me, that I talk to him and I listen, and I don't judge him for what he has done or how he feels. That I could be a caring individual. That's what this means to me. That's what this topic is all about. Not what I've done, but how I feel about what I've done and what it makes me feel like. And usually when I act out on a defective character, it's because I don't want to feel what I'm feeling. What I've learned to do here is sit through those feelings. No matter how painful they are, and they will pass. I wish I could do it perfect all the time, but I can't. And that's why I come here, because I still need you. Because without you, I wouldn't have anything in my life. Today I'm at a point in my recovery after so many years clean where those dreams that I had as a young boy and as a young man have come true in my life. I got the house, I got the wife, I'm going to have the kids. I have one on the way. I wish I could find the words to express the joy that I feel here today. I wish I could give every newcomer that walks in that door what I have gotten here. Because I care about that much about Narcotics Anonymous. See, I come here a lot of times because I owe N.A. N.A. didn't save my life. He gave me a life I've never known before. And for that, I owe, and I'm responsible. I'm here to share about what my secrets are and how I feel so somebody else can recover, because somebody else done it for me. That's what this is all about. It's about one act helping another. You know, and I wish I could help everybody that comes in the door, but I can't. That's what we're all here for. Everybody in this room has got a purpose. And for me, that purpose is to carry the message. To let the new person who walks in the door that there's no shame in what they have done. That it wasn't their fault they were born an addict. To let them know they're not the only one that feels the way they feel. That they're not going to be judged for what they feel or the things they have done in their life. That they're accepted here unconditionally. And that we will love them until they can love themselves. Because that's what they told me. And what they told me, they backed up. It wasn't just talk by Walter Narcotics Anonymous. They showed me. They sat with me. They held my hand. They listened to me cry. And all they did was love me. And that's something I've been looking for all my life, man. See, I finally found somebody I can talk to. And it's everybody in Narcotics Anonymous. I developed trust in certain individuals in my support group that I can tell anything to. There's some things now I can't tell my old lady, because she just don't understand. But when I stick my hand up in Narcotics Anonymous, never once have I shared something in a room of NA and somebody came up to me and didn't understand or didn't identify with what I was talking about. I need that in my life. That's what works for me. And I come here to do that and to give back because I get so much. And I strongly suggest that if you haven't done a fourth or fifth step, to talk to your sponsor. You know, don't do it by yourself. If there's anybody in this room who thinks they've done something nobody else has done in this room, I'm sure if everybody lined up here in a row and you talked to every individual, you'll find somebody who did what you did. You'll find somebody who feels like you do. You know, I came here and they told me we were not unique. That we have one thing in common, this illness or disorder is addiction. That makes us one of a kind. We may all come from different places. You know, I hang out with guys that grew up in the suburbs, came from nice houses, families, had all the money they wanted growing up. And I come from guys that grew up on the street. But we all feel the same way. You know, what's inside is all the same. And it's a beautiful thing when people like that can come together and do something good. You know, I don't like everybody that comes to Narcotics Anonymous, and I don't have to. But I definitely respect what they're about. They're trying to get clean. You know, it took me a long time to get to the point that I am in my recovery. And I thank God for giving me the willingness to do what I do. Because the thing I do best is run. Use and run and not feel. And I can't do that anymore. By working the steps of my life, I don't have that luxury anymore of running and hiding. I can't walk around for 3 or 4 weeks with something inside me and not tell somebody. Because I don't want to feel like that no more. That comfortable pain and uncomfortability we knew that was a way of life for me is no longer a way of life for me. Feeling uncomfortable is not comfortable anymore. My natural state is to be serene. I believe that. And I'm not afraid to show how tender I am and how caring I am and how sensitive I am anymore. I'm not ashamed anymore because that's who I am. That's what NA has given me. They've given me a sense of myself. That I don't have to pretend to be somebody else. I have to pretend to do certain things. I get it here for just being me. You know, and that is a gift that I cannot put a price tag on. They told me I have to come up here and speak for 45 minutes. I'm not exactly sure how long I've spoken. But I don't want to go rambling on because everything after this is going to be pure bullshit anyway. And I just want to thank everybody here for listening to me and inviting me up here to Canada. And I want to thank our Narcotics Anonymous for giving me my life. Thank you.
Joanne, I'm a recovering addict. I've got to start by telling you all a funny story. I got the call about a month ago that I was speaking at this meeting tonight. And I was very excited. And I got off the phone. It was in the middle of the afternoon, and the only person that was in the house was my daughter, who was 21 years old, or going to be 21. And I got off the phone and I said to her, guess what? They asked me to speak at the convention. I'm so happy. She says, what are you speaking on? I said, self-esteem. She says, why are they asking you to speak on something you don't have? And I smiled at her and I said, well, that's part of the reason why I didn't have it for a long time. Because I let comments like that get to me. And no, I didn't have it in the past, but I'm starting to get it real fast. I'm just going to let you know a little bit who I am and where I come from and how I ended up here, thank God. I'm 38 years old, and I was born in a section of Montreal that you can consider the other side of the track, and I was raised there all my life, and as a matter of fact, I still live there. And I was raised by two French-speaking parents, Quebecers, who raised us only to speak English, who educated us English for some reason. They could never give me a clear answer why, but there was a lot of things about the family that I was raised in that if I look back today, I can use to justify how I got here. And I went through probably the first 3 years of my recovery doing that, because that's what I needed to do. I was the only girl that was raised with four brothers, and I was abused by them all. Physically, emotionally, sexually, no. But as far as I was concerned, the rest was just as bad. And I was raised to believe that women were second-class citizens, that they had no rights. They were there to serve and make people happy, and that was their purpose in life. And I remember fighting that from a very, very young age, simply because when I tried to be the good girl and do all that stuff, I got abused, and I got told it was never enough, and that made me very angry. I can remember being about 12 or 13 years old, and I don't know if you know, but four boys that live in a house don't always hit the toilet when they go to the bathroom, you know what I mean? And I was on my hands and knees washing the walls behind the bathroom and washing the floor and being totally disgusted and figuring out why they couldn't aim properly. And one of my brothers came up behind me and kicked me up the rear end and said, good, that's all you're good for anyway, is to clean my shit, you know? And at the time, that triggered a lot of anger, and I went after him and I wanted to kill him. I had absolutely no idea how much pain it caused. And that was more or less the way they treated me. They were allowed to treat me that way. My parents let them treat me that way, and I let them treat me that way. When I was 16 years old, I remember getting the beating of my life from my mother because I got caught smoking when 2 days before she had given my brother, who was 14, permission to smoke. And that, I'm trying to watch my language here, people. And that screwed me up pretty good. I couldn't understand it. And the only explanation she had for it was that I was a girl. And that's the way it was. My mother was a very severe woman, strict. She was all of 5 foot tall, but boy, did she have character. And I became who she was. I admired her. I had her up on a pedestal. I admired her strength, her determination. My father worked 14 hours a day. He pumped gas. And he always made enough money just to scrape by. And my mother took that dollar and turned it into five. She would get up one morning, we lived in a 7.5-room flat, 3 stories, and she would decide that she was painting and wallpapering and changing linoleum, and she would move the furniture by herself. And by supper time, she had that room totally redecorated while having a pie in the oven and supper on. She was a tower of strength. So I thought, for many years. If I have to think back to the point in my life where I was trying to think this week of did I ever have self-esteem? At what point did I lose it? I don't think I ever had it. I wasn't taught to be proud of who I was, where I came from, to love myself. For the simple reason that the people that were rearing me, the people that were raising me, couldn't do it for themselves. And my mother believed as long as she looked like a martyr and felt like a martyr and acted like a martyr, she was being the best person she could be. So I grew up that way, and by the time I hit my teens, I was really angry. And because I was so angry, and because I wanted out, and because I wanted to have control over my own life, I honestly believe today that I did on purpose to get pregnant at 16. Somewhere in my subconscious, it was something I needed to do to get out of that situation. And I chose somebody that was even angrier than I was, and even more pissed off at the world than I was. And at 17 years old, I had my daughter, who is today going to be 21 soon, in a couple of months, and my son is 17 years old. And I got pregnant, and I went off on my own and said I didn't need anybody, that I was going to do it on my own. He didn't want the responsibility, he was afraid of it. And he started making empty threats. And I was such a nice person, I let him off the hook. And I walked away. But I waited about 10 months, and then I reeled him back in. And we just celebrated our 18th wedding anniversary a couple of weeks ago, and we're still together. My addiction and my decline started around when I was 16, when that anger came up. And until I learned to deal with it, until I learned to see life a different way, I was angry. And I went through about 15 years of using, trying to bury that anger. I heard a lot of things when I walked into this program, and one of them that I heard was, at the same time that I heard it, I laughed at it. I thought it was funny, but it bothered me. Somebody called me a candy ass addict because I didn't stick a needle in my arm, because I didn't have to go as low or have as low a bottom as some people had to go to. I had my limits. And I used whatever I used, and I abused it. But most importantly, I believe that I had become an addict. And to me, that means you can't deal with your emotions. You refuse to deal with your emotions at all costs. And when I came into this program, I was a shell of a person, and I knew I was, because I wasn't happy anymore. I couldn't live that way. And I spent the next 5 years staying clean, and I've been spending the last 2 years recovering. And to me, there's a big difference. There's a lot of people that I'm looking around, there's a lot of people that know me in this room. And I can honestly sit here and say to you that there's only one person sitting in this room that knows me. And even then, he has his doubts. I hid myself behind this protective wall. And I don't kick myself for it today. I don't resent the fact that I did that. I look at the reasons why I did it. And I needed to do it. I needed to protect myself from whatever it was that I couldn't deal with. And there was a lot of things. And today I know what they are. But at the time I was protecting myself from it. When I got pregnant at 16 years old, I went from 135 pounds to 210 in 9 months. And the years that followed that, I kept going up and up and up and up. And I tried all kinds of things, and I had certain successes, and then I'd gain it back. And I couldn't understand why that I'd get to a certain point in my diet and I could never break the 200 mark. And I went to a doctor one day and he said to me, "You've got a psychological block." And I said, "What do you mean?" He says, "You won't allow yourself to be healthy. You won't allow yourself to go under that mark because something is scaring you. And until you take a look at it, you'll never succeed." Well, in the last 7 months, for those of you who don't know me, I've been going around all day shocking the hell out of a whole bunch of people. In the last 7 months, I've lost 110 pounds. And I did that by going into a hospital and having an operation, which is called a gastric bypass, which is not recommended for everyone. Only the emotionally stable, so I've been told, and they told me I can have it done. And it took me a long time to get to that point, to make the decision to get it done, and I don't regret it at all. I feel healthier and happier today than I've felt in my whole life. And sometimes when I see somebody come up to me with this look of shock on their face, most of the time I really love it. I like what I see in their face. I like the look of them being proud of me, being happy for me, being happy with me. And other times I feel angry. I feel like taking them off in the corner and saying, "Do you know what it took me to get to this point? Do you know how much work I did on the inside before anything happened on the outside? An incredible amount of work. An incredible amount of pain, I've got to tell you. Because that's my master motivator. And I don't move until I'm hurting real bad." And the events that triggered the changes in my life today were very painful ones. This woman that I described to you before, who was my tower of strength, who was on a pedestal, within 4 years became a total invalid in a wheelchair. She couldn't even hold a cup of coffee. She couldn't even wash herself. I went over twice a week and gave her a bath. And I was so angry. I was so angry. I used to say to her, "But I know you can. Just try to boost yourself up. Try to make yourself feel better. Do something." You know, I couldn't stand to see her deteriorate the mind like that in front of my face. I couldn't stand it. And it got to a point where my father, who was 20 years older than her, he was 80 and she was 60, was the one that was taking care of her, along with the rest of us. And then all of a sudden, my father had a heart attack. And we spent 3 days in the hospital watching him die. And that's what I learned. That's the first time in my life I really understood what powerlessness was. I stood there at the foot of his bed and I watched that monitor go down. Go down till it's at zero. And I watched the life just drain right out of him. And I turned around and I looked. And when he was brought into the hospital, my mother passed the next year wanting to die, having nothing left to live for, being in constant pain day in and day out. She had arthritis, very, very painful arthritis. And her daily routine was a dessert dish, about this big, in the morning, about 30 pills, and in the afternoon, about 15. And at night, about 40. She had a pill for everything under the sun. And me and my arrogance, in my first couple of years of recovery, told her she was a man. And her being a stubborn bitch as she was, I'll show you I'm not an addict. Stopped every pill she had. And got worse. She was taking 2 shots of insulin a day, diabetes. And she lasted like that for almost 10 months. And then one day, I walked into her house to give her bath. And she said to me, I need to talk to you. You're the only one that's going to understand me. You're the only one that's not going to want to put me away. I want to die. And I want you to be there with me. How can you ask me something like that? You can't ask me something like that. Don't ask me. I understand what you're going through. I'll take care of you. I'll love you. But don't ask me something like that. I'm too selfish. And for the next 2 months, every time I went over, that's all she spoke about. And she drove me insane. My relationship was falling apart. My kids were teenagers. They were making me crazy. And my mother was making me insane. And then I got a phone call one day that she'd gone into the hospital again. This was routine for her. She was in 3 or 4 times a year. And I went to see her at the hospital. And I remember going out into the lobby and saying, please, God, suffered enough. Come and get her. And sure enough, in the same hospital as my father, exactly a year later, in the same room, in the same bed, 3 days, I watched her die. And at one point, she called her children into the room, one after another, and she said to me, and this short conversation that I had with her that lasted about 2 minutes was the thing that changed my life. She said to me, you know, I've always been more hard on you than any of the other kids. And she says, you always thought that I didn't love you. She said, that wasn't the case. She said, you're just so much like me. And it took me almost 6 months before I understood what she meant by that. And what she meant by that was that she could not love herself, so how the hell could she love me? She never in her whole life was able to put herself first, was never able to love herself. And I just reminded her so much of herself that she just couldn't. And when I came to that realization almost 6 months later, I made myself a promise that for the rest of my life, come hell or high water, I will be number one. And I will take care of myself. I will not end my days the way my mother did. And it was so scary, because now I'm sitting there, 315 pounds. I can hardly breathe. I have no, I'm looking for the word in English. No desire to enjoy life at all. Spending my days in front of my TV. And it hits me what she meant. Well, that was it. I was off and running, people. Off and running. And I told the people in my life, I'm getting what I need for me. I'm making myself happy. And you know what? I want to share it. Everybody that I love. But don't try to take it from me, because it's mine. And don't try to stop me from getting it, because I want it. I work hard for it. I deserve it. And anything that I see in life that I want, I believe today that I can have it. Anything. Anything. Most of the time I feel fine with that. And then some of the times I get my guilt buttons pushed. But the thing that saves me from that insanity today, most of the time, it's because I've learned some important things in this program. And one of them is that nobody can make me feel what I don't want to feel. And nobody's responsible for the way I feel. And I'm certainly not responsible for the way you feel. I understood and I learned what kind of power I had over my own life and nobody else's. I learned the hard way that life is too short, and if I see something today I want and I don't ask for it or I don't go after it, it doesn't mean tomorrow I'll be here to have it. And God forbid that I die tomorrow and I haven't done everything today to make myself happy. I did a lot of work inside. I looked at myself. I looked at the person I was, because I believed for many, many years that I was a wonderful person. And I was loving and I was giving and I would do anything for you. I'd give you the shirt off my back. But don't try to give me your shirt if I'm cold, because it's okay. I'm fine. I can deal with it. I'm the pillar of strength. Yeah, like a ship. I was falling apart inside, bit by bit. And I was hiding behind this wall. And I came to realize that I have a lot to give. And I have a lot to share with the people in my life, but I haven't got anything if I don't go get it for myself first. And I can't depend on you. I don't want to depend on you to give it to me. That's a big responsibility for another human being. My happiness? They'll go insane trying to make me happy. The only thing I can do is find my own happiness and share it with you. Love myself and then love you. And I'm working really, really hard at doing that. And the walls that I'm running up against is all these changes that's going on inside of me The people that have known me for years just don't understand. They just don't understand. And I don't know if it's my job to explain it. The only explanation I have is look at the smile on my face. Just look at the smile on my face. I'm happy. I'm content. Now, if you love me and you have a problem with that, well, then it's your problem. Because as far as I'm concerned, I can't give you what you don't have. You've got to get it yourself. Because I'm too busy getting what I need. And that sounds really selfish, and I hear the words coming out of my mouth, and I almost want to take them back. I've been on a journey for the past year that's just so... I have lived in this district that I told you about all my life, and I'm 38 years old. And I, out of the blue, decided I'm moving to Toronto. I've been offered a wonderful job there. There's people there that respect me, that respect the job I do and the person I am, and they want me. And I said, hey, you want me? I'm going. And I was offered that position a year ago, and my family said, no way, we're not going there. And I said, okay. And I turned around and I walked the other direction, because that's what they wanted. And everything they wanted, I had to give to keep peace. So Joanne always put aside what she wanted. And I continued going and working there. Every 2 months they'd call me up. I went last summer to train the person that was taking my job. And, of course, she didn't do as good a job as I did. And every 2 months, they'd call me up to clean up her mess. And I'd go up, and I'd clean up her mess, and they'd say, why don't you move here? You know, why don't you move? Can't. Family doesn't want to move. And then I went back up in August, and they said it one more time. Now I'm feeling good about myself. And I said, yeah, why don't I move here? And so I called home, and I said, sweetheart, I want to move to Toronto. I want you to think about it, come to a decision, and let me know. He says, you've already made up your mind. No, no, no. I haven't already made up my mind. Well, I need you to tell me what you're going to do. If you've made up your mind that you're moving there, and even if I say no, you're moving there without me, I need to know. I said, no, for once in your life, you're going to make a decision based on what you feel. Not on what I feel. Not on if I tell you I'm going to go and I'm going to leave you, then you'll say, okay, I'm going.
For the conclusion of this presentation, please turn your cassette over and depress the play button. Do not rewind your cassette.
Make your decision, I'll make my decision, and we'll come together in the middle somewhere. And for the first 2 weeks, he was totally insane. And I loved him for it. He'd call me with all kinds of cornball ideas on the phone. I couldn't believe it. I gotta share this story, and I hope he doesn't get upset. But I just thought it was adorable. One of my bosses, I think he's a great guy. He's got a funny personality, and I get along with him. He's great, okay? But people, he's not my type, all right? And I came home, and I told my husband how great this guy was, and he's so funny, and I liked being around him, you know? And I was telling him, you know, it's so sad to see, because he laughs through his pain. His wife's got cancer, and she's really sick, and he's really afraid to talk about it, and blah, blah, blah. A week and a half later, he had me divorcing him, moving to Toronto, shacking up with this guy after his wife died. And he told me this story, and I loved him for it. That's his insanity. That's his insanity. And if he only knew, I wouldn't change him for the world. We went away for the first time. We've been together now for 21 years, and we have never been out of Montreal together. We never had a honeymoon. We've never been on a trip. We've never done anything but change diapers and pay bills for 21 years. And we scraped up some money this summer. We went to the Canadian convention in Vancouver, BC for 10 days. And we had our honeymoon. We had the most wonderful time that we both of us have ever had in our life. And I came back from there saying, this is what life is? Well, I want it, and I want it all, and there's nothing that's going to stop me. Nothing. And most importantly, is I want to do it with him. One day he'll believe that in his soul. My life is so wonderful today. And I can sit here and thank a lot of people for it, because a lot of people had a lot to do with it. One of the most important people in my life that helped me through these changes, helped me come to realize what kind of changes I needed to do to feel good about myself, to love myself, was my sponsor, the most wonderful person that I've met in a long time. She's a very, very special lady. She's the one that got me to dye my hair red. Believe it or not, I would have never done it without her. Never. And she's just so special to me. And this decision to move to Toronto means that I'll lose contact with all these people that I love for a little while. And it's scary, but at the same time, it's so wonderful. I've got today a taste in my soul of what life is all about. And like I said before, I want it all. And I love myself enough today that nothing and no one passes before that dream. Nothing. I'm not ready to give all that up, to go back out and use. At the end of November, November 29th, my husband and I will be celebrating 7 years clean, and we never have to go back out and use. Never. And I'm not saying that with arrogance. I'm saying that with humility, because I'm one of the privileged ones. Why? I don't know. Because I coasted for 5 years that I did sweet all. I did nothing but one meeting a week and service coming out of my eyeballs. And I latched on to people and I built solid relationships, but that's it. I didn't work any steps. I didn't open up to anyone. I stayed cold. I stayed closed. I could smile at you. I could hug you. I could be your friend. But don't try to get in my soul, because you're going to back off real fast. Because I didn't want anybody to know that there was another person inside. And it wasn't at all the person that you're seeing. I was upstairs in my room before coming down before, and I thought I was going to be sick. I said to somebody, I've got to go to my room, I think I'm going to be sick. I was so nervous, they said, go get some pretzels. And I went upstairs and I sat down and I talked for a few minutes with a friend. And then I went in the bathroom and I looked at myself in the mirror, and the biggest smile came across my face. And I said, yeah, I love you, Joanne. You are a great person. And you're going places, babe. I'm talking to myself in the mirror now. Thank God I'm alone in my room. I said, you're going places, babe. Wherever you want to go, you're going. And you deserve it. You worked hard for it. And don't let anybody take it away from you. Most importantly, I don't want to do that alone. I want to share it with people. I want you to see me in 6 months from now and see that smile on my face and share it with me. Because it doesn't mean anything if I'm all by myself and I have nobody to share it with. In closing, I'd like to say that it was very painful and a very long process to get to the point I am today. And if I feel this good after such a short period of time, I can only imagine what the future is going to be like. And then I'm smiling again. And if there's anybody in this room that likes to write, you write a letter to my daughter and you tell her I've got it. And in the long run, she's going to come to see it herself. Because it's hard for me to sit there in front of her and tell her that I love myself, because she'll crack up at me. But I do. And I'm able to look at myself today. So yeah, there's a lot of changes going on the outside. And people see me and they go, like Carmen did before. It was so wonderful of your face. But when you see somebody that's made so many changes on the outside, you could be damn sure there's 101 more changes that went on the inside. I thank you for showing me that I can be the best person that I can be. And I'm really anxious to share and to show people that think they knew me who I really am. I'm happy and content. I'm beautiful. And I'm old. I haven't got over that one yet. My hair's not red for anything. They were gray. And I just think life is wonderful. And anything that's going to be thrown my way, I can handle. So in 2 weeks, I'm off to Toronto. And I'm going to share something with you before I leave that I'm having difficulty with. My life isn't all rosy, you know. I've been working there, like I said, for a year, and I haven't done a meeting there yet. And everybody that loves me is freaking out because they're afraid I'm going to go there and I'm not going to continue recovering. And I was trying to figure out why that I could not bring myself to call the 101 names and numbers that were given to me of members that live there and look up the addresses that I certainly have had for over 6 months in my purse and do a meeting. And I came to the conclusion it was because of my fears, and it was because I was afraid they weren't going to like me. I was afraid I wasn't going to fit in. I was 16 again. And I made this little justification saying, oh, well, I'll wait till I move there and then my husband and I going hand in hand to the meeting. Right. Like I always needed him to protect me. And I can't bring myself to go. And that's what I'm looking for this weekend. I'm looking for the strength to go off to Toronto Monday night to work, because I've been working there for 2.5 months. All week, and I come in on weekends. Talk about insanity. And go back there next week and make a real honest effort to walk into a meeting. With my luck, there'll be about 4 people from Toronto here. They'll come and get me after the meeting. I just thought of it as it came out of my mouth. I'm serious. I'm going to make an honest effort. to walk in there by myself. And I believe that the answers that you're looking for, if you haven't found them yet, because you're not looking in the right place, they're all inside of you. Don't be afraid to dig deep. Whatever comes up shouldn't be there in the first place. The good stuff lies underneath. Your dreams. Did you ever have a dream? Did you ever have goals? Did you forget them somewhere? They're not lost. You just forgot them somewhere. Look for them. Find somebody that can love you until you can love yourself. I thought I'd never get to the day that I could see my dreams again. I honestly believed at one point that I was going to end up like my mother. But I don't believe it anymore. And that's because I've taken control of my own life. And I put it in the hands of my higher power. And I believe as long as I do the footwork, he's responsible for the results, not me. So I have no failures. I don't fail at anything anymore today. If it happens that I don't get what I want, it's because it's not what I need. And I'll find out in a little while why I didn't get it. It'll be revealed to me. There's a lesson to learn. But that relieves me of a huge responsibility. I am not responsible for the outcome. I just have to do the work. And I'm doing it. Thank you very, very much for listening to me. And it's been a privilege to share with you tonight. Enjoy the rest of the convention. Thank you.